Come on. Hello and welcome to Dynamite Neddy. It's the Retro Games Podcast where a couple of ow pals get together and talk about a couple of ow games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mick Clockerty. Joining me this evening, we have Mr. Andy MacArthur.
Konnichiwa.
Mr. Mick McCormick.
Hello.
And then returning for the first time in a wee while anyway, we have got my wee brother, Aero, Aaron Clockerty.
Howdy.
Aero, what have you been doing since your last Neddy appearance? Video game wise, anything notable?
I mainly been playing a shit ton of stuff like Disgaea, like the new Disgaea 6 drop not too long ago. I played that for a bit.
Need a time sink during the pandemic, man. Disgaea's got you covered.
I know, exactly. I finally got round to playing Persona 4 Golden.
Oh,
that
nice.
That was amazing. Embarrassingly, like, hit max level, like, two dungeons away before the last dungeon, so...
Did you do the secret dungeon and all that?
Aye.
Is it worth doing all that shit? Because you'd been... Obviously, being a big Persona 4 fan, you'd always wanted to play Golden, but because it was on that fucking Vita, it was awful hard to get a hold of. Now, having played it, was it worth all that fuss after all, or is the vanilla version kind of just as good?
Well, I think maybe giving it a wee bit of space between playing the vanilla one and playing this one might be a good thing, because I always find that when I'm just about to finish a Persona game, that the new enhanced edition's coming out and I've burnt myself out on it after playing it for 100 hours, that I don't want to look at it for, like, the enhanced version.
I fucking loved Persona 5, right? The fucking 140 hours or whatever I spent with it, right? And that was 2 years ago. I've got no plans on playing Persona 5 R or whatever it is any fucking time soon. It's too soon to go fucking through it all again. Even longer this time. Don't get me wrong, I will one day, but it's I'm not ready.
I was going to say, fair point, McCormick, because the last time I actually played Persona 4 was the vanilla one on PS2, like 10 years ago, if even. But playing this one, it was really good. The new lassie they added in is about as cringe as they make her out to be online. She's not a very popular character.
Is she a party member? Social link, the whole shebang?
Not a party member, but she's a Velvet Room attendant. And they try and play it up like this kind of like big, awesome mystery, but it's not really that interesting. But if you want to do all the bonus stuff, you have to go through it all. So, double-edged sword. But I had a ball playing it. I absolutely loved it.
So it's worth doing? Good final dungeon and all that?
The new dungeon they add in's not great, but it's more Persona. You're not going to complain about it. Plus, it gives you more things to do with all the other party members. So that's well appreciated. Get a hang out with Kanji more, which is never a bad thing.
I think the wee PSP version of Persona 3, which is like a right fucking streamlined version of it. Do you know, all the bits where you're no day in the dungeon crawling are pretty much just like a visual novel, or your social link dates and all that. They added Mare in, and they added like a version where you can play as a lassie, and then you get access to completely different social links. You get to see all this extra fucking content with the characters and all that. If you're into it, that one's worth a look, and you can fucking download it on the wee Chinese handhelds. Maybe we can bleep this. No encouraging piracy.
Only if you
Nintendo.
Own the original, of course.
If you
mention Nintendo, they'll be doing you like a fucking... Oh my god, man, you see shit they got up to when people mention their OPs online. See, OCs online. See, like, get on YouTube and even, like, putting, like, just, like, some footage. Persona's not Nintendo, but... So they put like footage of fucking Mario Kart or something, get shut right down.
One it fucking winds me up is that they shut down fan projects and all that. It seems just fucking antithetical to the idea of fucking games to me. Do you know what I mean?
Complete opposite of Sega that kind of embraced the whole fan community. It's like, I make all the fan games you want. It's great. The more the merrier. And then like somebody tries to make like, I don't know, a new Chrono Trigger or something. They've got like the lawyers fucking writing sternly worded letters to them as soon as it makes a peep online.
A Sonic official Twitter account would probably be like retweeting you if you made like pregnant Sonic ROM hack or whatever. They'd be like, this is class.
Sega sound, so long as you don't make, you're not like, selling it, making any money. But Nintendo, see, like, that's just, I think it's because they like re-releasing their shit, don't they, in certain ways and different
ways. It's a bit like Disney. They want to they want to put it back in the vault, and then the vault. Like a new generation of Wains comes along and they re-release it for like full price.
Aye. Here, I had a thought the other night, right? It's funny you mentioned that, by the way. And it's like, you know how now we live in the age of like content, and we live in the age of like two clicks and you've got whatever you want, doesn't matter what it is. Will that ever come to an end again? And like fucking will we end up with vaults and like restricted content?
Yes.
T-shirt.
I think they're already fucking positioning it around, you know, like, see anybody with a bit of sense, you just get all your stuff in torrents, right? They'll no fucking, don't arrest you for that. But see with laziness and see paying, what, £6 or whatever for Netflix or that, I just do it fucking easier. Can just flick it on with a remote. But no, right. You can't get it all on Netflix. You need to have fucking Amazon Prime, and you need to have Disney Plus, and they're slowly fucking reintroducing the idea of telly channels to like incredibly online Wains who seem to just be buying it hook, line, and sinker.
And like Steam as well, like there's no precedent for like games getting taken off Steam and then they put out like the enhanced version, you've got to pay for it all over again. You've not got a collection as such when you've got, you know, Netflix or Steam or Spotify. It's purely at the behest of like the company that owns the platform. You're just borrowing it.
Yeah.
And now that they can take stuff away from you, then they're going to do it.
What about this NFT shit where it's like digital physical media?
I think that's going to be part of it as well, because that's like, it's a way of creating like scarcity in a digital world. Like you can't just make infinite copies anymore, like because it's encrypted now. You've got to have the NFT, which there's only one copy of, or there's only 500 copies of. Like that's how they're going to do this artificial scarcity.
It's fucked up, man. There'll always be a way around it. Hackers will always bail us out, hopefully.
Well, you know? Aye, exactly. And fucking the real heeds among us will still be able to get our ROMs. Sorry. If you obviously own the physical copy as well. Wink, wink. I've got a wee... not necessarily what I've been playing recently, although I have been playing the Game Boy Advance Castlevania game, Aria of Sorrow, I think it's called.
Nice.
Very, very good, worth checking out if you like Symphony of the Night. But what I wanted to mention was that Aero, my bro, he turned a big 3-0 there recently.
Hey,
and we had I'm just sitting here polishing my best brother ever medal because we had a day out arranged on Saturday where we did some stuff, but we went to that Super Barrio in the city centre of Glasgow.
Cool.
Which is cool as fuck, man. They had a lot of cabinets that you boys would be mad for as well, Andy in particular, because they've got an actual Mortal Kombat 2 and a fucking Crazy Taxi.
Man, I tell you what, it's just up in Merchant City, isn't it?
Merchant City, aye. Just down for... Aye, if you're walking along Tron Gateway, aye, it's dead easy to find.
Aye, it's great.
Right, let's go, man. Let's give our Neddy a day out.
All the systems are kind of, it's just free to play, isn't it? Like, you don't,
not
if
anymore,
I remember
sadly,
right, not anymore. Right, it's a shame.
Well, they have one cabinet on free play, and then the other ones you had to put like 50p or a quid in. But the one they kept on free play was possibly, maybe because I had the most goes of it, was probably my favourite arcade machine we played that night. It was X-Men versus Street Fighter.
Oh, nice one.
Oh, was that an
SNK
game?
Well, that one was an arcade game. Like, all the best Capcom stuff, it was very arcade-centred. But the Saturn got it as a fucking exclusive year before a version came out for PlayStation.
I'm sure that was one of the Saturn games that came out with some Saturn games came out on cartridge and disc. A weird thing.
So maybe.
Saturn cards. I think that was one of the games. But the cartridge only came with a memory boost. It's like a 4 meg memory boost.
So the Saturn one was pretty much a perfect port, whereas the PlayStation one didn't have certain features like being able to swap out characters, which is a big fucking part of that whole Marvel versus Capcom thing. It was a one-on-one rather than a two-on-two and things like this. But yes, I liked X-Men versus Street Fighter enough to fucking Anorak and read that about it anyway.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've never ever sat and played in Mortal Kombat 2 on an arcade, so I think I'm going up to do that, man. I'm actually going to Glasgow on Friday. I might pop in. Is it open during the day or is it just a nighttime thing?
I think I'll double check, because it might be the open at 5 or something like that. But,
better get this right or they will only give us a sponsorship money this week.
I know, it's free fucking plug here for Super Barrio.
Do they grub and stuff or is it just... Like,
And it's a wee bit on the pricey side for drinks as well, I should point out. But we got a cocktail pitcher. It cost fucking £20, mind you. And it was called a Tonic the Hedgehog.
I'm sold, man. Bucky in it, I'm fucking me, man. I'm sold. Got to go.
It's worth checking out. They kind of rotate the systems around as well, so you might get something different each time you go there.
All right, so they update them every few. Where the fuck do they get them from?
Well, I was talking to one of the staff at least about the pinball machines, because as you know, the eagle-eared listeners will know that I'm a wee bit of a pinball wizard.
She was saying
that there is a guy in Paisley who fucking owns fucking hundreds of pinball machines, has like a warehouse full of them, and will give them out to pubs, like just to put in them, if he can like take the money out of them or whatever. He's like running a rare pinball business in fucking 2021.
Roger Daltrey.
They had a couple of good ones. They had Star Wars. They had, I think it was a Simpsons one. And a fucking the best one was a Tales from the Crypt one. But the backboard wasn't working on that.
Aw.
But aye. Decent times.
Tales from the Crypt, brilliant, man.
But why don't we kick off the mince and totties of this week's episode and get into our games? We had technical difficulties with our first game after the hitch, which was supposed to be Terminator 2 for the C64. I just, for love nor money, could not get it fucking loaded onto the the mini version of the microcomputer thing.
C64 emulation is no joke. I was struggling that way as well.
I think most of the big popular games, they've made ways to play them fucking a bit easier. But I thought Terminator 2 was maybe a wee bit better received than that, but I think it's a RoboCop game I'm thinking of. But anyway, I asked Andy for a sub, which he kindly has provided in the form of 16-bit kart racer, Street Racer. So Andy, if you can tell us why you picked Street Racer.
It was under duress.
Well, it was one for his, list and for his wee pile.
I'm going to invoke the wee pile analogy this week. This was one of my wee pile, and I don't know how it got into my wee pile, because this is quite a late entry. I think I got it out of the wee shop along for St Mary's. You know, the school we used to go to back in the day. There was a wee kind of second-hand shop.
It's another wee bit of identity theft part of
it. There's a wee second-hand shop that used to have like 5 or 6 Mega Drive games on show that you'd look at every day walking by, and it was always the same old shite. But I remember a new one appeared.
That second-hand shop was actually quite short-lived for how often you talk about it on this. it made an impact on me as well, because I think we used to have to walk past it.
Aye.
But it was a wee Sega shop, and I don't think it was there for that long, really.
I think it was mostly a second-hand furniture shop, and I think it just had kept a wee games bit.
Oh, maybe that's it, aye.
And they kept the games bit in the window, but like, the games were usually ones you already had, like Sonic and Micro Machines, whatever. I think a new one popped up, and it was just a cart, and I was like, what is this? We're in, and it looked like Street Fighter, because it's got a Street Fighter logo and shit, but...
Well.
Sort of. But so I thought to myself, right, cool, what better, what's more needed than a wee pile analogy? So, there you go, so I thought I'd hit you with that one.
Well...
Did they call it Street Racer because it's Street Fighter but a racer, kind of?
Well, this is... You're getting in... You're stepping all over my beautiful notes here, Mick.
Sorry.
So, just to kick off quite quickly, if anybody's interested in these factoids, it was developed by Vivid Image and published by Ubisoft, or Ubisoft, I don't know, for our American listeners out there, you fucking children.
To French listeners, it's the most important.
Ubisoft.
Where is me ma?
The SNES version came out in 1994. And the Mega Drive version came out in 1995, so Andy, you're correct, quite late. And the Mega Drive version was a PAL release only, although fucking interestingly, this game also had fucking Amiga PS1, Saturn and PC releases right up to the end of the late 90s. It was getting ported all over the shop, sometimes with big graphical upgrades here and there.
Do you remember me playing this? Because I played it quite a lot before I got my Nintendo.
I honestly have no recollection. It must have been a fucking, like, a dull patch in our relationship. We must have all been going to each other's houses very often when you hit this one.
So, the
Dark Years.
the developers at Vivid Image had quite a simple fucking idea, which was basically that they could create the ultimate couch co-op, couch versus game rather, local multiplayer I should say, by combining Mario Kart and Street Fighter.
Oh.
Some would say that's quite a cynical idea.
That is, it really is.
Spoiler alert, they didn't quite achieve this. It's a decent wee game in its own right, but hence this is why, if you look at the graphics, it looks maybe like a wee bit more of a polished version of Mario Kart, and if you look at the logo particularly, it's like, who are you fooling? Like, is this a licensed Street Fighter product? Because the font looks the same and everything.
The thing is, but look, there's not really any Street Fighter characters in it except E-Honda.
Well, you've got... This is part of the reason I like kart racers as well, as opposed to regular racing games, but I was going to mention this a wee bit later on. Probably my favourite thing about Street Racer is that you've got a right fucking roster of wacky characters to choose for. It's quite kind of wacky races patter. As you were saying, there's an E-Honda type character called Sumo-san. He's just a big fat sumo wrestler in a go-kart.
Sumo-san, for fuck's sake.
That's what he's called. Oh, yeah, the characters are actually, unfortunately, kind of racist caricatures as well. Sumo-san and the African guy in particular.
Oh, no.
The German guy is obviously a Messerschmitt pilot.
Yeah, Helmut. He's like a Red Baron kind of thing. His car can kind of turn into like a, what were you saying, a Messerschmitt or something?
A Messerschmitt.
It's kind of its time that way. The only lassie character is like a kind of blonde bimbo who's kind of sexually objectified, called Surf Sister.
Aye, kind of based on her Dick Dastardly and Muttley.
Penelope Pitstop.
But Penelope Pitstop, yes. To see, for my money, this could have leaned into wacky races a whole lot more than it did. As I say, with the mashup of Street Fighter and Mario Kart, it doesn't really work. So the kart racing modes, you've got your standards, you've got a bronze cup, a silver cup and a gold cup. It plays kind of like SNES Mario Kart, only it's slightly less drifty, it's a wee bit more arcadey. In my opinion, it's probably a bit of a better kart racer than the original Mario Kart. It just handles better. So the kart racing mode is, you know, complete thumbs up. It's when you flick onto brawl mode, which is supposed to be all the cars and they'll be in arenas and you've got to like battle lumps with each other, try and knock each other off this platform. It doesn't work, it's boring. You end up just driving around each other in circles over and over again, and it takes ages before MD gets eliminated.
I think there's a mode like that in later Mario Karts, maybe 64 maybe had it.
Well, talking about this game being an influencer, Street Racer has a FITBA mode that is car FITBA, predating Rocket League by 21 years.
Amazing.
This was my favourite. It was quite intriguing, by the way, right? Because back in the day, this was kind of my first foray into like 3D, man. Because Mega Drive never really had Mode 7 or anything like that. Like, it never had any. It had Road Rash, right? Road Rash was kind of like it. But this kind of upped it a wee bit, kind of, as you said, kind of play like Mario Kart. And somehow they pulled off the kind of Mode 7 effect.
Yeah, this is what I'm trying to figure out, because like Mario Kart, the whole reason they made that was to kind of like show off this amazing graphics mode that they had in the SNES that nobody else had. So like the fact that they can sort of like emulate that on the Mega Drive, I don't know how they pulled it off, but it sounds pretty impressive.
It is the same technique, because as you can tell, there's no hills, and you can tell it's a big sprite that's been pasted on the flare, whereas Road Rash, you can tell it's been animated, do you know what I mean? But
looking at it, this does look to me a bit like Road Rash, actually. Is this that same kind of, similar kind of...
Maybe it's just done really well, then.
A SNES version, controversially for this podcast, I like a wee bit better. It's got a better button layout. For whatever reason, they designate punching to the left and punching to the right as two separate buttons, which on the Mega Drive is mapped to on the A button and the B button. And if you're holding down C to accelerate and you're also steering, it's a wee bit of a fucking pain in the arse to try and punch people. Whereas in the SNES, it maps them to the two shoulder buttons, which just feels a lot nicer playing races on that one.
I suppose I'm thinking back to what I was saying. Outrun was kind of, was Outrun kind of the same vein in Hang On and all that?
Aye, same. It's the same idea. Aye.
Same trick, probably.
Yeah, yeah. It's...
just done a wee bit better.
The character that I ended up playing as was the obviously quite like to look for a monster in a character roster.
Yep.
And in this one, we had the bold Frank, who was just pretty much a straight up rip off of Frankenstein's monster.
So it's Frank's monster.
Frank's monster.
I'm guessing that's your blanker in the game, aye.
He's very much the... a lot of games don't go for a literary Frankenstein's monster. They go for a Hollywood Frankenstein's monster. So right. You get a big, bulky, green-skinned fella with bolts in the neck, which is very much what Frank is in Street Racer.
Did you notice you get, like, a nose rimmer? You know how you always get a nose rimmer? And, like, Micro Machines, you get one... and,
there is one in Street Racer. I can't remember his name. It may be Raph or something like that.
Yeah, kind of golden boy sort of character. Yeah, clean cut kind of guy.
Peter Perfect.
Oh, he was
one of them in the Wacky Races as well.
Peter Perfect.
Yeah, they played it for laughs though, because he was like full of shit and he kept losing.
His racer was just straight up a phallus machine. I can't unsee it.
it was making me think Frankenstein's monster being part of a lineup of characters or roster is actually surprisingly common in video games. See, when you think on it, like, how many games have you played where there's been just like a Frankenstein, even if they call him something else?
It's a good character, man. Timeless.
It's probably got that Dracula thing as well, where you can just put him in anything because the copyright's like past its date or something.
I
know, like
that. You can't just call him a Frankenstein, can you? It's like calling Mike Myers a Halloween. Do you know what I mean? It's Frankenstein.
You can call him a Frankenstein, I think. It's like calling... well, unless you want to be a pedant, but I'm not going to dig somebody up for calling a vampire a Dracula. And go, wait,
let's leave semantics out of it. It's too late in the day for that.
obviously, Frankenstein's monster, or the monster, or the creature, is what it's called in the book. But cunts just call him Frankenstein now. But yeah,
we've lost that fight. the pedants have lost that fight.
You've got Castlevania, Darkstalkers, shitloads of fucking... I actually looked through a big fucking list of Frankenstein-related media, but I think we've diverted enough. We're going into Wacky Races.
Zelda's another one. Like, a lot of people haven't played it. I think Zelda is the main character. It's fucking Link, mate. Come on. Link.
Yeah,
that's just a trolling thing at this point. Aaron,
do you remember Dr. Franken, which was a Game Boy game that we had, where you were Frankenstein's monster and you had to go about a big spooky mansion trying to find pieces of his missus to put her back together because the other monsters were like jealous of them and broke her apart?
Vaguely. Like, at first I was like, what are you talking about? But the second you're like, I can almost picture it.
It was a creepy kind of Metroidvania style game where you just explored this mansion, and then there was only ever one tune playing in it, and it was Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, a fucking 8-bit version of, just looped over and over again. And
so
knew that I hink on it. It's the first place I ever heard that tune, and it's a great example of music being like the entire thing that made it scary. Because it's supposed to be like fun, I think. He's running about in his PJs, but because Moonlight Sonata is playing over and over again, I associate it with pure horror and being like creeped out a wee bit and full of wonder.
Did you ever like go to a wedding or something? Like, that's the fucking song for Dr. Frank.
I'm sure it fucking happened when I was watching like a movie or something like that. This is actually the second time because Dr. Franken is going to become slightly relevant again when we're talking about Castle of Terror, so there you go. But yeah, my conclusion on the old Street Racer then, there's fun to be had with it, but I think it's a good kart racer, and as I say, I particularly enjoy a wacky character roster, different motors to play about with different special powers and that. I don't think the blend of violence and racing really works, though. And as has already been mentioned here, Road Rash just does it so much better. There's a couple of times I was playing it and I was like, just play Road Rash. This is good, but it ain't Road Rash.
Nah. Aye, it's near Road Rash.
It's near Road Rash.
Okay.
That's going to be a thing for now, on listener.
Andy, did you have any other thoughts on it as a member of your wee pile, or will we move on?
Well, I didn't know what Mario Kart was at the time. First Mario Kart I played was the one for the 64, so I thought this was like quite an original concept.
I think in this neck of the woods, most people's first foray into Mario Kart would have been the 64. SNES's weren't really kicking about that much.
Nah, the only one I knew, there was a wee minging guy for that field that had one. he had Mario All-Stars and that, and they used to worry about me. They were out playing Heidi and that, and all I wanted to do was sit inside and play fucking Mario All-Stars, and the sun's fucking scorching, though. But, I know SNES was few and far between, but this was probably one of the first ones. The one where you're saying about the Fitba, that kind of blew my mind, man, because it was the first time I seen, like, this kind of concept of 3D being used in all range mode, almost. Like, I don't know.
I really wanted the Fitba mode to be more fun than it actually was. it kind of also doesn't work. I really fucking like the balls, the idea of it, the concept, but actually playing it, it's like, right, this doesn't really work.
I think I was just getting into Fitba games at the time, and I had Sensible Soccer, and I was thinking, yes, I've got another one now. But you're right, it wasn't really, was it? It was just the idea in my head. That's why these 16-bit games are so good, because your imagination is still getting utilised to some degree.
Aye. Well, shall we move on then? McCormick, why have you... Well, obviously being that the podcast is called Dynamite Heady, would they have a bit of obvious preference for a particular developer?
Yep.
But why have you brought Sin and Punishment to the party on this episode?
Aye, so this is one that I think like most people I played on the Wii Virtual Console, I didn't play at the time, probably because it only came out in Japan. It didn't get translated until much later. But I mean, all the Treasures games are pretty fantastic. They've got a pretty great track record. I've always been a massive fan of Lilac Wars, and just like that kind of style of game, you know, that or Panzer Dragoon or something, one of those kind of 3D on rail shooters, and this is like Treasure's kind of take on it. I was kind of instantly sold on it just when I started playing it, just the whole kind of the aesthetic of it and the colours and that, and then pretty tight gameplay. So it's kind of nothing like revolutionary, but I thought Ariel might quite enjoy it.
I really enjoyed it, thank you. Fortunately, much like yourself, I also bought it way back when on the Wii Shop during that short-lived Hanabi Festival thing they did.
Yeah, that was like they had a few games that only came out in Japan, but that was like their kind of first sort of official release was on the Wii console.
Japan and America, and it was a Europe-only event where it was the first time like we got games officially, like Super Mario RPG, Chouaniki, and stuff like that.
Here, by the way, also, if I'm thinking right, Earthbound.
Earthbound was much later. Like, Earthbound was like 2015 technically, or something ridiculous like that.
The Wii release,
it may have even been like Wii U. Like, that's something though, like I've always had in the back of my mind. Like, I think the first official release of Earthbound was like stupidly late, like just last decade.
Interesting. Sorry for diverting again.
We should do an Earthbound special at some point, man. A follow up.
Yeah, maybe one where the four of us can get together and play it, you know, kind of have a wee round table discussion. That sounds quite good.
Aye, that's like that.
Novel concept.
Because there's a lot. I only go to the.
Are you still in the monkey maze?
No, I get by that bit, but apparently, like, things get really fucked up towards the end, and I've missed it all.
Sorry, I've got to stop talking about Earthbound.
If you listen to the episode, you might know about the trippy stuff that happens at the end.
I know, I know you've talked about it, but the experience it's supposed to be like fucking a bit creepy, man. I quite like creeping myself out with games, so I would quite enjoy that, I think. So I think we should look at that again at some point. But here we go, we're away down the rabbit hole.
We covered it extensively. Just because you're only listening when we're recording.
Andy, right, I'm not being funny. I think we've possibly given more airtime to Earthbound than any other game. The amount of times we mention it, even in passing, Fly Honey and all that. Like. However, even after that, I'm in Team Andy. I want to do another Earthbound special. Anyway, Sin and Punishment.
Yeah, it was part of that Harry Bye Festival. I still had my old save from way back when I first played it. I never actually finished it. I got very near the end, and I was kind of interested in revisiting it properly and doing it justice.
Help me picture in my head, have we got a Space Harrier res type situation where you're a flying person and the camera is to your back and you're shooting things ahead of you?
You do not fly. The best way to describe this would be an on-rail shooter platformer, I would have to say.
Yeah, you're kind of mostly restricted to moving left and right, but you can shoot, you can move your shooting cursor in two dimensions. But you do a bit of jumping as well. I don't know if you duck, but you can run left and right and jump.
And you get a Mega Drive roll as well. That's Mega basically Drive. All your movement.
N64, Andy, I think.
Oh, sorry. That's what I meant. N64. Man, I think I played this game back in the day.
As they were saying, it was Japan only until it came out. It was a special release on the Wii.
No, I'm getting this mixed up with something else. Jet Force Gemini.
I've always wanted to play that.
Jet Force Gemini, I think I'm getting it mixed
up. That
is
quite similar, actually. Yeah, it's a bit kind of two twins fucking shooting into the screen, so I can see how you get them mixed up.
But I was going to say, the second I booted it up, that intro cutscene played, immediately I had to check audio atrocities to see if this was on it, because, oof, it was... I got very... this is such a weird reference to make, but... Tatsunoko versus Capcom, when they added Frank West to it, they wanted an English guy to voice him, so they just grabbed anyone that could speak English in Japan to voice him. So you have everyone else speaking Japanese, and then just Frank West speaking in perfect English. That's what it felt like for a lot of these characters, where they literally was like, can you speak English? Yeah, okay, you're voicing Sake. Can you speak English?
That's how they did the voice acting in Shenmue. It was for some reason, the producer was adamant that they had to have English voice actors that lived in Japan and could do the recording in Japan. So that's not a very big pool of people.
Well, games like that don't have dialogue; they just have statements. It's they'll say one statement. There's no interaction between the two kind of bits of script.
So, do you have any choice lines for the for the voice acting?
It's there's. You get a wee lassie following you around who's obviously evil, but the game tries to play it up like it's a massive twist that she's evil. And there's bits when you're just fighting enemy soldiers, and she's just look at them, they're all dying, they don't even have the chance to run away. But so many of the lines, just because how fast.
And that wee girl grew up to become Pretty Patel.
The game is that fast paced. It's every time a line happened, the subtitles in this game are only Japanese kanji. There's no option for English subtitles, infuriatingly enough. So I'd just be shooting at something, and I'd be Saki, what's going on here? It's coming to my voice. And I'm wait, what? And then a building would just collapse on me, or a big bug thing would pop up in the ground and kill me.
I found the story of this game absolutely baffling. I played through it a few times when I originally got it. I did not have a clue. Having since seen Neo Genesis Evangelion, I can see that they've cribbed a good few scenes, or at least kind of motifs from that.
Did they initiate Third Impact at the end?
There is a bit where you kill one of the monsters, and then fucking hundreds of buildings fall down and blood spills everywhere, kind of when the angels die. It does look a bit like Third Impact's happening, but I don't know story-wise if that's what's going on or if it's just a kind of visual reference.
This game very much wears its references on its sleeves. I've not seen all of Evangelion yet, but I kept getting reminded of that. At one bit, your main character, Sake, kind of mutates, and that kind of gave me vibes of Akira. And one of the boss fights in it is just straight up the ship from Outlaw Star.
Ah. Speaking of boss fights, no, you've said the treasure buzzword. Are there 400 boss fights in this? Do you get four per level? And
it's nuts. Like, I didn't really notice how much Treasure liked their old boss fights until I played through this and realised, oh, aye, in Gunstar Heroes you fight Hunters of Folk as well, and in
Dynamite Heady,
there's like a boss fight in like every segment, but here it's nuts. It's like every segment has at least 2 to 3 boss fights. And this is only me playing on normal mode. Apparently hard mode adds in even more bosses, which, holy shit.
From what I'm seeing to you, I mean, a lot of it was done as well too. For N64, it was terrible. Try to look at anything for a distance, like draw distance, it was awful. But I see it's doing the same sort of thing as Lilac Wars, in that the camera's kind of, I suppose, call it the N64, it works. The camera's kind of slanted so that you kind of see too far ahead of you, which means that for a running gun game, you know, it gives an illusion that you can see everything coming, but you can't really.
Yeah, it's quite a good looking game, I would say. I like the kind of art direction. Like, if you look at the kind of 2D Treasure games, they've got quite distinctive character design, like the characters in Gunstar Heroes with quite kind of long limbs and that, and like this one kind of takes that and kind of translates it into 3D quite well. I think it's like quite colourful and that. You can kind of always kind of tell that it's quite legible what's going on in the screen, even though there's a lot of good chaos in that. So yeah,
looks really good for an N64 game.
Weirdly enough, one of my notes were they didn't want to focus too much on making the game look good. They wanted good performance over graphics.
There's a lot of stuff kind of moving on screen at the same time.
It's so fun. Like, I think I sweated through like 3 shirts playing it. It's intense. But the whole time, damn near 60 frames, runs perfectly. Even with the Wii emulation I was using for it, I thought the whole thing was grand just playing through it.
Yeah, I think even if they don't have like a lot of polygons, if it's kind of moving smoothly in that and there's not any glitches, like that can be what makes it kind of look good.
Aye.
And the levels are like quite dynamic as well. Like the one that I kind of remember is the one where you've kind of like, I think your main character is maybe psychic or something, but you're kind of like telekinesis floating this platform that you're standing on, and then the kind of platform.
Like eyes on the screen.
Fuck. Yeah. Like, 2-2, by the way. That stage in particular drained
is it
so
solid?
Many of my life's eye.
One thing N64 is good at too is it's not very good at having hands or polygons on the screen, but it's good at fucking like showing explosions, big colourful explosions and tractor beams and shit, man. Like,
I always like those kind of effects, man. I always think those look like cool.
It does this amazing atomic bomb effect, man. Lilac Wars does it really well.
So Lilac Wars is, for me, probably just as fun now as I played it when I was like 12 years old at somebody's house. Is this still a lot of fun, or is it mostly fun but you notice some of the cracks? What was your kind of overall experience on it?
My overall experiences were I had a lot of fun. Felt like there's a couple of segments that went on for too long. Like I said, level 2-2 is like the longest in the whole game.
Alright.
Way near the end, they make a really weird choice. Like, the penultimate level of the game is a straight-up side-scroller. Like, it's no longer on rails and you're just running side-to-side. That level is atrocious. I think that's when I gave up when I was younger, too, because my old saves had that level. So, that was really baffling, but everything else is a lot of fun. I felt like I couldn't really get a hang of the controls sometimes. Like, I would constantly forget my character placement from where I was shooting and stuff. But overall, great game. It only took me like, 2 hours to beat, but I did have to do 2 attempts. I game overed my first attempt playing it, so
I've actually got another techie question that's came to me. Given that a lot of N64 games were designed that made quite good use of the controller, Lilac Wars, again, being a fucking prime example, you're fucking about pressing all kinds of triggers and shoulder buttons and all that. Did you play this with a classic controller, or how did you navigate playing it, given that you played it on the Wii?
I'm kicking myself for this, but I actually bought a brand new classic controller to play it, because I have it on the Wii U now, because I ported all the stuff to the Wii U, and the Wii U doesn't let you use GameCube controller. So I had to do that. What? Little did I know that Sin and Punishment was out on the Wii U virtual console, and I literally just could have paid a quid to upgrade my Wii version to the Wii U version and use the gamepad instead of paying, like, I don't know, a tenner for a separate classic controller.
But
it seems Nintendo, like, bastards. It potentially could have been quite good with the Wii remote and the joystick, if you imagine, like, kind of pointing at the screen and shooting and moving with the other stick. Is that an option?
I am so happy you said that. It is not an option, but 10 years later, in 2009, they did release Sin and Punishment 2 for the Wii. What McCormick was saying, just using the Wiimote, pointing and shooting, I wanted to play like that so badly. I actually bought the sequel and gave that a bash too, just to see how it plays with the Wiimote and Nunchuck.
How does it hold up?
Amazingly, the sequel's a lot of fun. Going back to what you said earlier, now your character gets like a wee hover pack, so you can actually fly around and you're stuck to the ground the whole time. Just being able to like point at the screen and like shoot things is a dream. And they kind of add in a Lilac Wars-esque like targeting, like hold in and you can throw a bomb and stuff like that. So the sequel is amazing.
Do you prefer the sequel to the original?
Sequel is a lot harder. There's no lives in the sequel, but because they're like, okay, we've got it down on pat, we can turn this into a proper bullet hell. So there's literally going to be like only one area of the screen where you kind of get hit. So the sequel goes full sadistic on you. Like, the sequel is like a 4-hour game, and it took me like 10 hours to beat just because of how difficult it was.
I was going to say as well, like, this game kind of made me discover like a weird thing about a lot of my favourite games, where I always like a game where you get a sword and a gun at the same time, and I don't know why it appeals to me so much.
Pretty cool. Like,
I'm thinking back. Yeah, you've got a kind of, because it's like you're shooting, but you've also got a sword that can like deflect any projectiles.
Aye, like hit like missiles and stuff. Aye, I forgot.
Yeah, but thinking back to like a lot of the games I really like Mega Man Zero, you got a sword and a gun in that. Persona or the Shin Megami Tensei series, you get that in that as well.
Well, you're a Final Fantasy VIII man. That fucking sticks it to them together.
I think that might be it actually. Having the fucking the ultimate weapon of all time, a handgun. Handgun connected to a sword.
Does the Fallout games not allow you to do that? It's a shield in it. A shield in it.
That's not the same. Actually, I don't know, I've probably mentioned this on the podcast before, but like when they were doing like the motion capture for Final Fantasy VIII, the cutscenes, they gave the actors like replica gun blades, but they had to stop using them because they were so unwieldy to use them in life. they just gave them like swords and like just edited the kind of hand in real life because they're really fucking awkward to use. There's a reason nobody ever invented one in human history.
They did.
a proper gunblade.
The 17th century, there were fucking flintlock pistols that had fucking swords on them. I think they were making them. See, I'll look up. This is for after the podcast. I'll send you a Wikipedia article. At one point, the US Navy had pistol swords. I think this was before the 20th century and things like that. But there are fucking real life instances of the gunblade.
I'm glad to be proven wrong, but I also want to find out the survival rate of the soldiers that had them.
But Aaron, once again, completing his game for Neddy to the new heights by going, I'm going to fucking beat a sequel and all.
I think he's already been promoted to Big Boss. What's left?
Bigger Boss.
Is Grey Fox? Grey Fox isn't above Big Boss, is it?
More of a sideways move.
Yeah, by the way, Gunblade's a fucking cracking game. Man. Remember that? Do you remember that game for the Saturn?
No, I was expecting you maybe to go down the route of going, well, I don't know, I knew a guy up Larkfield who grafted a gun to a sword.
Gunblade was see the arcade machine with the big fucking turret gun? It used to move with moving parts and shit on it.
Yes. Remember?
That was it. It had two of them.
Maybe I've seen this.
You would have. I guarantee you've played Gunblade, man, aye?
Well, Aaron, we don't really know how to give you a rank up because we think you're at the top rank. But do you boys have anything else to close off Sin and Punishment with, other than I presume it's a recommendation and whatnot?
I was gonna say it's a recommendation, but the only chance you can get it is if you've got a Wii U. So maybe if you can somehow get a ROM of it. If you could get a ROM of it and play it with mouse and keyboard, I think that'd be fucking incredible. But I strong recommendation, but I don't know whereabouts you'd find it.
You've just driven up the resale value of the Wii U by a couple of hundred quid, so I'm going to announce that I'm selling my Wii U.
Hey!
Ooh. What about that lovely copy of Knuckles Chaotix you've got that's up at fucking $6,000 now?
Aye, that's my backup plan if I lose my job and I can't even pay rent with it.
Is this the N64 cart inflation you're paying all of that?
£700.
Okay, I think that brings us on to Castle of Terror, which I picked for McCormick. Basically, we've got a text adventure. The reason I picked it for Mick is because after Planescape Torment as well, we are slowly but surely just turning this into a reading competition between each other and try to introduce lots of teletext elements that Andy likes. No, I remember back in the day, it was an episode of Consolvania, probably before they were on YouTube and that even. I think you had to go and fucking watch them somewhere mad on some other webpage. But they did a special where they looked at all fucking Speccy games and C64 games. But I could fucking barely remember playing any because I would have been so young. Rob Florence did a review of Castle of Terror, and that was always one that I thought, if I'm ever fucking about with C64 games, I'll check that one out. And I did, and I quite liked it. I like the blend of... it's a text adventure, but also you've got a lot to look at. You've got to kind of look at a picture. You've got these kind of detailed environments you've got to scan about. And also, it was a happy coincidence that Big Mick, a.k.a. the Elder McCormick star, was a big fan of the Hobbit text adventure, which is actually a lot more famous than Castle of Terror. That was a giant back in the day. But it's the same mob that made the both of them. So I thought that was worth recommending it for as well. So
when you say
how did you get on?
Do you mean like the old Zork style ones where it's just like text and nothing else?
So this is a wee bit of a kind of a wee bit later than the very old games. Like, I think Zork was possibly like out in the 1970s or something. But they kind of wanted to progress these games a little bit by adding some graphical elements. Like, nowadays there's been a bit of a resurgence in text adventures, or they usually call them interactive fiction, but those games, almost all the time, all the ones I've played, it's purely text, maybe a wee bit of music. But there was a period where they thought, like, you know, where can we take this, how can we kind of progress these games, and they hadn't quite reached sort of like point and click levels, but they added a wee extra bit of graphics as well. But it was interesting going back, because as you said, like, my dad used to talk fondly about The Hobbit on the ZX Spectrum, and this game's very similar to it. It's a kind of standard kind of text adventure where you've got to sort of type in commands to say what you want to do, like go north or kind of pick up objects or whatever. But you get a little scene for each level, kind of lets you visualise things in quite a kind of quaint way that the C64 kind of draws the screen, like, onto the screen, like, in real time. Like, you can kind of, it's almost as if a pen is kind of going around and like making the shapes and kind of filling in the details and that, which I guess was like a kind of technical limitation at the time, but it's quite cool. It's almost like there's a wee artist sort of like try to paint this scene in your mind.
That's pretty cool.
I found myself quite liking the graphics, like the wee men working in the field, or when you get into the castle later, the portrait with the eyes following you about in that. I think everything kind of had a wee charm about it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Commodore 64, not very many pixels, not very many colours, but the little kind of like tableaus are quite nice. It's a simple game. It's a simple story, basically. You're in this village with a castle where the Count lives. I don't know if they were allowed to use the word Dracula. I don't know if that's another copyright kind of issue. But the first half of the game is getting told by an old man at the bar that his daughter's been kidnapped by the Count. In the first half, you're just kind of trying to make your way into the castle, figure out how to get into the castle. And then the second half of the game, you're in the castle itself, and there's kind of various kind of hazards and stuff like that.
It plops you in the middle of this village without telling you fucking nothing, really. Yeah, and Andy, you have to go to a pub called the Duck Inn and buy an owl man a pint. And that is the crossing of the threshold to initiate your adventure, is to buy an owl man a pint. I quite like
nice
that.
One.
Yeah, that's the start of an adventure in Glasgow as well.
But seemed as a support.
Well, it was. I called that adventure discovering my sexuality.
So yeah, it's. I think with a lot of these old games, one of the main kind of struggles you're going to have is like the with the parser, like trying to make it understand what you're trying to do.
Yeah,
like you can press a command and it tells you all the things you understand, but like. You'd be typing in, like, get this, and it's like, I do not understand get. It's like, okay, maybe it's pick up, or maybe it's, like, use. And then, like, I was like, or how to talk to someone. Like, I kind of struggled with a little bit as well.
There was a bit in Dracula's Castle, after I'd already get in, where, for the fucking life of... It was a skull puzzle. Like, remember
yeah,
I said
you
had to, like, press a skull in? It gives you a hint, and it says, depressed... i.e. press the skull. But to do that, you had to snuff out a candle first. And I was like, snuff out candle, put hand on candle, push candle. It just wasn't fucking... And then I went, fuck this. And I looked up a walkthrough and it says, you type unlight candle. And I was like, come on.
Unlight?
Yeah, there's easier ways to say that.
Yeah, there's always so many like, verbs you could understand. You can kind of see why like your point-and-click games are such a revelation, because it's like, yes, finally, I no longer need to like learn all these words and kind of to understand what to do. You can just like you just have them listed out on the screen and you can choose them and then use them on an object.
So obviously, growing up with the word bank, the LucasArts style, you know, pick up, talk to, walk to, blah, open, close, blah, 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 whatever you get, I'm a big fan of it. But I've read articles and stuff for kind of older heads who played these things back in the day who see the fucking point and click word bank as something of a dumbing down. And it's kind of streamlining, if anything, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit of a kind of a simplification because, like, usually with the objects in this game, like only there's only one word that's going to work on it. Like,
yeah.
So there's no reason in giving you like 50 to choose from.
Remember,
you can only use like one of them for each thing. So
exactly,
there's more trial and error than I think actually like the puzzle solving stuff.
Depending on what education system you're in, like even if you're in the Scottish, English, or Irish education system, you get taught vocabulary slightly different in the curriculum. So,
well, you can't. You know, if you're on Ireland and you're typing in like "talk to your man" and it doesn't understand you, you can't use slang or anything. It's pish. In terms of the actual puzzles of this game, it does the Sierra thing a little bit of like it really enjoys killing you, which I think like a lot of the replayability would have been the fact that you're maybe dying quite a lot in this game. The most egregious one, which you've probably encountered, was in the mill. There's a mill where you have to go and pick up a what is it? Is it a torch? There's something in.
There's a lantern, and if you don't move, a big fucking sack of flour or something like that, it makes an explosion. What happens
if you don't move the flour before you pick up the lantern? You trip over the flour. You knock the lantern down, and it burns the mill with you inside.
That's flour.
That's a game over. Oh no, a bag of flour like for making bread. but the image doesn't make it look as if that bag's in the way. It's like it's over on the corner somewhere. You're like, how did I manage to fucking trip over that on the way to the lantern?
It's
the side of the room.
It's a gotcha in it. It's to make a game longer.
Yeah.
Also, I think it pissed me off with the mill is that there are two identical mills that are separate, distinct locations.
They look exact same. The picture is the same.
Yes.
But they've got different hangs in them, and you need to go to both of them for like what the fuck is that about? There's only about like, I don't know, 8 to 16 rooms in the game. Like, but did they be like, oh shit, we've got to have two mills? Why does the village even have two mills? It's only about five folk living there.
It's a small village. because one of the mills, I worked out how to get into the castle, fucking pretty much without looking anything up. I was dead proud of myself. But there's a mill you have to go into. It's convoluted shite. Well, you break off the bottom of a ladder, and then you look at the rung, and you realise that that can be used as a key and the wheel that fucking props up the door to get into the castle.
It locks the door so that when you walk through the door, it doesn't fall back down on you and kill you.
I've been to villages like Inchinnan, where it's like a kind of industrial hub with three toons in a city or something.
It's got hundreds of mills. That's where all the flour and all of fucking Romania comes from.
So I did that. And then I got into a castle, and then I eventually get killed by a fucking spider or a knight. Or no, I get locked in a treasure room. And then eventually when I chucked it and tried again, for the life of me, I couldn't work out how to get the fucking rung off the bottom of the ladder again. Sat here typing all these different fucking commands and all that. Then I chucked it, and I went back and played it, and that's when I realised... Was that 2 miles?
Of course. Another kind of slightly clunky thing is, and I don't know if this is just me, maybe it could be with my kind of bit of shoddy sense of direction, but it seemed like the kind of a lot of the directions didn't really make sense. Like, I feel like you could go east, west, and then east again, but end up somewhere different.
Like, yeah,
they're not kind of the screens only laid out very logically.
You end up double backing yourself and ending up outside the pub quite often, which I don't know if that's just me and Larry.
Sounds like real life.
Somehow you always stumble across it. Apart from the kind of horrible puzzles, like there was some kind of alright ones. Most of them are generally quite logical. Getting into the castle and kind of like taking on the various obstacles there, probably the kind of highlight of it, where you've got kind of suits of armour coming to life and attacking you, and you're like picking up books to kind of get into secret passages and stuff like that. So all that stuff kind of makes sense.
How far did you get out of interest? Did you manage to get up to the count? Did you get to see him?
I actually finished it, but I used a walkthrough for a couple of bits.
No, Aero and Andy, this game is infamous because the creator of the game, a guy called Graham Willis, revealed afterwards that you can't fucking kill Dracula in it.
But he planted a lot of hints that you could.
Yes.
It was trolling. It was intentionally trying to stoke some of this kind of playground lore stuff, I think.
I can because even on my first try, stuff like that.
Yeah. Even if you did the game perfectly, you would not get, I think it's 300 points or something like that. It would always tell you that you were missing points because you would be like, I saved the lassie, but I didn't kill Dracula. But you couldn't fucking kill him, aye. And it was so that the Andy Max of this world could go, aye, I killed Dracula.
I caught Robotnik.
Aye. So you turn up in Dracula's room, you've got to have a cross that you took for the church that you passed on the way.
You get a dusty cross for the chapel. I had that in my inventory.
So that paralyses the count so that he can't attack you. And then you hit him with a spear or maybe another weapon you picked up. Not a wooden stake, interestingly. I don't think there's a wooden stake.
Well, one of the fucking gaming magazines at the time printed a fucking letter for somebody who claimed to have killed the count, and they said that there was something you had to do to break the spear that turned it into a stake, which sounds kind of in keeping with the game's fucking logic.
Sounds plausible. Nobody's been able to like reproduce it.
No, so they were talking shite.
Yeah, or maybe it was the developer. Just he sent the letter and wind everyone up. But you do that, and then Dracula turns into a bat and then flies out the window, and then you kind of rescue the fair maiden. You go out and you cross the moat, and then that's you back in the village. Although if you don't unequip a suit of armor, you drown while you're crossing the moat. So that's how I died, like at the very last hurdle, which is one, like, fuck you. Fuck you.
One last wee fucking fuck you to the player. Yeah. Love it.
So me as fucking like Mr. Soundchip guy, can he finish a review of his Commodore 64 game without talking about the music, I don't think?
I'm fucking keen on talking about the music, and this is why this game also made me think of Dr. Franken, because I think, for me, this game, the bulk of the horror, or the horror-like atmosphere, because I think it is at least a wee bit creepy, if not actually scary, all comes for the soundtrack.
The music is good. It's I guess what you can imagine for like sort of Dracula media, it's a lot of like that kind of Baroque sort of like harpsichord type sound and stuff, you know, creepy like classical or Renaissance type of music.
Can we chuck in one of the music pieces just now?
Yeah, go for it.
And then, do you want to give some spiel about the Sid chip? Because I've been waiting to hear about this actually.
The Commodore 64. One of the things it's really kind of known for is its sound, in kind of comparison to like other consoles at the time, even consoles like that came out like later, a good deal later, like the NES. Like the sound that they could produce wasn't as advanced as the Commodore 64. The reason being was that when the Commodore 64 was getting made, they approached somebody to make the a sound chip for it that was actually like a musician in a keyboard designer. Like before that, I think sound was always like a secondary consideration.
Did Rob Hubbard actually make the fucking chip itself, or does he just make all like the best tunes for it?
Yeah, I think he's just the most well-known composer.
Right.
Robert Yanis is the name of the guy that actually invented it. He went on to found a company called Ensoniq, who made a bunch of like synthesizers in the 1980s. So he was a musician, kind of synthesizer player, synth designer. Most other consoles that came out at the time, sound was all, it was just for like making bleeps and bloops. Like they didn't think they could ever actually use these to make music. Like the ZX Spectrum, like it took a lot of effort to get music in a ZX Spectrum game. There was one game that was kind of famous because it had music and gameplay at the same time on the Spectrum, which nobody thought was possible.
It was Matthew Smith with Manic Miner just replaying. I don't know the name of the tune, but it was in the Butlins adverts. it just loops out Ernair again, and he was like 18, and he worked out how to fucking do it, and every cunt was like, "How the fuck did he manage that?"
The Dizzy not have that. The Dizzy games had the fucking tuned in it. I tuned it played over and over again.
They're probably after Manic Miner, but
They're good, man, for like the first 15 minutes, and then you've got to turn it down.
The kind of thing that made the Sid special was basically that it was making the most out of like kind of very simple kind of hardware that they had at the time. All you had really was like three what's called oscillators or like sound generators that made a square sound wave. And if you've ever listened to like a square sound wave, like the kind of default sound on a synthesizer or on like the NES, for example, it's not always the most like pleasant thing to listen to. It can be quite a harsh sound, and that's basically all you had in like most other consoles at the time. But as a guy that kind of had designed synthesizers, he knew ways to kind of make this sound a lot more musical, in tricks that like didn't take a lot of like extra hardware to accomplish, but like could make the sound look so much richer. So like there's a filter which basically takes away either the high or the low frequency of the sound. So that means that you can have a bass sound, but only bass or only treble. And that kind of gives you almost like different instruments. Each sound has its own kind of place in the mix. You could also do a thing called like an arpeggio. So it's basically playing one note after the other really quickly. So you can have chords almost using one note played really quick. You could make a chord. So that gave you kind of even more sounds. And then there was various different things modulation, which basically just gave like a much wider range of like of sounds. So when you're making a tune on the SID chip, you're not just writing down what notes you want. You've got a lot of control over like what each instrument sounds like. And yeah, Rob Hubbard, as Mick said, he became kind of legendary for the kind of amazing sort of symphonic like soundtracks he managed to make.
They're so fucking good, man. Like, I probably my favourite thing about looking at all C64 games, the most famous ones anyway, is that the soundtracks are all fucking bangers, man. And, well, the soundtracks, it's usually one song, do you know what I mean?
but they're always, like, 9 minutes long. Aye, and it's epics.
It's fucking Rob Hubbard that made the fucking bulk of them as well.
Yeah, aye, he was a bit of a genius, but the chip has kind of had like a life of its own, kind of like long after the C64. Like, people enjoy kind of like making new tunes on it, like even to this day. There's some bands that have kind of like incorporated the SID sound into their tracks. One of the kind of like things that appeals to people about it is that it's analog circuitry, and like the thing with analog circuitry is like no two SID chips sound the same. Like if you play the exact same tune on my Commodore 64 and your Commodore 64, they wouldn't sound the same. Like, they'd be subtly different because of just the kind of imperfections of the hardware. So that's a kind of, like, almost, like, slightly magical thing about it as well. Like, people, they try and take out the chip of their old beloved console and, like, implant it in a new one because they want that same sound, like...
That's amazing.
To carry with them for the rest of their lives.
It's like having that specific guitar.
Like a guitar or like a pedal or something like that. It's yours, you know. It's purely yours. So there's something kind of quite magical with that, which you're obviously not going to get now that it's in things like where it's just playing like kind of perfect CD quality soul. Sound.
Digital isn't getting any soul, man.
Well, I kind of really beat the old kind of analog soul of these old instruments. That's the reason that fucking analog synthesizers go for like thousands and thousands of pounds as well. Yeah, this Castle of Terror, it used that to quite good effect, kind of a lot of like interesting kind of wee sounds, kind of spooky sound effects with the pitch going up and down.
A couple of different sort of creepy wee tunes, even for just, there's a couple of different ones that play at different parts of the tune, and then there's a different ones in different rooms of the castle and all that. You get quite a few tunes for a C64 game in this.
And it's one of those ones where like you can kind of tell that something bad or creepy is going to happen when the tune changes and becomes quite a bit suspenseful. Like that mill, like it's just a fucking ordinary mill, but why is this tune playing over it? What's this sense of impending danger here?
This is ominous bread. And to kind of cap this off as well, I just fucking love Dracula. I love Dracula stories.
Yeah, we did a whole D&D adventure about it.
I plug for Dracula's Divorce D&D module, copyright Mick Clockerty.
Unfortunately, in this game, you kind of give like a rousing like speech to tell Dracula how much of an important guy he is, and then like play arcade games with him, as was lovingly kind of improvised by Leo during that episode.
Do you reckon that in the future that these text games might make a comeback, like when the AI improves?
They've made several comebacks.
All right, but what about a conversational sim where like the AI is so adept at human language that...
Yeah, you've played it. It's called Facade.
Oh, exactly. Good shoot.
Bad acid simulator.
I mean, I think that could have been the case. I think Facade maybe set that back about 20 years. Because right. It's so uncanny.
McCormick, I'm afraid you're going to have to leave.
Melon.
Aye, but who knows, man? Everyone's making a lot of fucking big claims about AI these days. So you never know.
And maybe they could fucking make a version of this game where you can actually kill Dracula. continue with your final thoughts.
A good 30 or 40 years later. Final thoughts. I think this is more of a kind of like interesting as a historical artifact for me. The gameplay for these is quite archaic, but I was definitely interested in kind of seeing the history of these kind of adventure games that I've known and loved, and like the spaces between like your old Zorks and that, and then how they kind of got to your LucasArts adventures and the ones that are kind of beloved today. So it was interesting, and you kind of beat the bold Dracula.
Exactly.
Not in this game.
I think you had King's Quest, which had a character that it let you control with the arrow keys, but then you had a text parser where you still had to type to pick things up and that. And then I think the next jump in evolution after that was either Monkey Island or Maniac. If you're wanting to chart the, you know, the ape to man on that one.
Yeah. Aye, King's Quest is a weird kind of missing link though.
Yeah. But brings us to our marquee game of the evening. Aaron, you'll need no encouragement to talk about why you love this and why you've picked it for Andy. And you didn't even know that he had a wee bit of a weird kind of Neo Geo fetish. But if you take it away, Aaron, why did you pick Metal Slug 3 for Andy Mack?
Well, for me, it's because Metal Slug was always a holiday arcade game. It felt like no matter where you went on holiday, you would always find an arcade cabinet of Metal Slug 3, which is incredible. So I just knew that Andy loves his big detailed sprites and stuff like that. And I was like, this will be right up his alley for the sprite work alone, let alone like the real fun like gun and run gameplay and just everything else about it.
Right. I do like these games, man. I mean, he's going to have to help me out a bit because there's just, for a game that's only an hour long, there's fucking so much going on, man.
It's chaotic as hell.
It's a sensory fucking feast banquet, man. To a point where, like, you feel like Henry VIII after it, man. You've ate too much fucking chicken drumsticks or, in this case, like, too much melon. But it's a running gun game, much in the vein of Gunstar Heroes or Contra. And I do like these games because they share a lot in common with my favourite genre, which is, like, well, one of my favourite genres, beat-em-ups. And that you're constantly going with, it's horns of chaos on screen, there's mounts, there's just a general kind of chaos that you can immerse yourself in. But this takes
it. Andy's already given this a 10 out of 10 because it's got mounts in it.
Is it slugs? Is that what a slug is, Aaron?
They're
robots.
The tanks and like the mechs and everything you can get. I think like the camo and the elephant are the only two proper mounts though.
So this game fucking, we mentioned on the group chat, we've got a wee Neddy group chat and mentioned on it there's only 5 levels, but man, each level, right, they've basically covered every part of planet Earth and beyond in this game. And the 5 levels.
Branching paths as well.
There's like 4 different branching paths in each level, aren't there? And one minute you're in just like this kind of swamp area, and then the next minute you'll find yourself in ancient Egypt, and then you'll be in fucking underwater, and then you'll be in outer space, and then you'll be in like an alien warship. But it's just everything. Because as Aero said, this is an arcade game. I think it'll only get released up until, I think it only got released in like the year 2000, didn't it?
Aye, 2000 was when this game came out, when everyone else was toying around with 3D.
3D,
SNK,
aye.
We're like, nah, we're sticking with 2D.
Let's make one of the greatest 2D games ever made.
And you do get that for it. You do get, they've just sat down, man. Who has it made this game again? SNK?
SNK, aye.
You tell they've just sat down and went, right, listen, man, right, fuck the 3D. Let's just use everything we've learned for the fucking 16-bit and arcade era and try and just throw everything at this game. And they have every effect here. Every conventional effect has been sort of perfected and used in this game, man.
It's like what you say about the Sega Saturn games and that, Andy, and, you know, SNK are a prime example for it as well, where a lot of the King of Fighters games and that in the late 90s and the 2000 and that, where they kept this kind of fucking 2D artwork and just went for really fucking beautiful detailed sprites. And you've got to admit, like, they were right with the benefit of hindsight. Like, imagine this was made with pure ugly early 3D. It wouldn't have been nearly as fucking good to play. Exactly.
They definitely hold up a lot better, but if you think about it, it's kind of equivalent to, like, you know how nowadays you've got them 3D engines, you get like a Frostbite engine, the Unreal engine and all that, and they're standardised, so you can't really get a bad looking 3D game now. Well, I suppose this was like that version of that for like shoot 'em ups. You know, this SNK had like the perfect engine for what they could use. They had all the effects like sprite scaling, they had like fucking, help me out here, Mick, lighting effects.
The thing about the Metal Slug games, it's not even a technical technique, it's like an art technique, and I can't explain it. Like, I don't understand.
Animation.
It's fucking wizardry to me, but it's called subpixels, and it's the way they kind of draw things. It's like you can put in like more detail than the pixels should have. It's like an optical illusion. I'm not explaining it very well, but like there's a pure distinctive look. They look so fucking more detailed than they have any right to look. Like it's incredible.
It's like a wee kind of stop motion aspect to like the animation in this game. But man, like the boss, there's not even just bosses, there's like enemies in this, like the big fucking barracuda in level one and like the big hermit boss. Well, there's one character, right, the big baddie, but he's got so many different moving parts that are all independent of each other. It's weird, man. It gives this kind of weird effect. I don't know if that's kind of what you're talking about.
And even like the kind of things that are like meant to be like mechanical, like they kind of they move in kind of like quite human sort of like not realistic ways, but like every kind of like tank or fucking mech in this game's got a lot of personality to it and its movements and that.
Aye. And these games can tend to be quite difficult, man, and this is no exception.
It's rock solid.
I always think the hardest one of these I've played is Probotector for the Mega Drive. Well, Probotector.
Contra 3?
Contra for the Mega Drive, aye. Fucking solid, man. Like, get by first level of that, and you're like... Well, it's sort of on that level, because... What I find is these games, the sprite work is amazing. They're so detailed, and we're talking about animation there. When you kill the character, the sprites, they've got this death animation. They're so fluid, they can almost turn into liquid. But there's so many of them. There's like the same amount of sprite might appear 60 times on a screen.
My favourite sprite and just general feature in this is the wee fucking POW guy. Who whaps out a pair of his dirty pants and goes, thank you, and gives you the heavy machine gun and that. I fucking love that cunt, man.
There's a lot of quirks like that in this game, man.
I thought he was meant to be a POW. I thought he was a hippie, like a peace act.
No, you're rescuing him.
He's got a big long beard.
Aye, because he's been fucking locked in an internment camp.
John McCain.
There's a lot going on in this game to a point where like, sometimes you just don't know what's happening. But when I first went fat, I was like, what?
Uh-oh,
because, like, the fat power-up is fucking... right, so the power-ups, Aaron, was always... So we used to go on holiday to this place in fucking Catalonia called Estarte. Don't think it's too far away from fucking Barcelona, but there was one holiday I remember where... And I think it was still fucking pesetas at the time. I don't even think Spain had the euro at this point. There was a wee bit where there was a bar and you could go and play pool... And there was a Metal Slug machine, and Metal Slug 3, and he spent a fucking entire holiday next to this thing. And I've got a memory of him going, come here, you need to come and see this. And I went over to the cabinet, and he was like, look, you can turn into a zombie mode, can fire out blood with your mouth. And I was like, that's pretty cool, to be fair. But the power-ups in this, for that reason, have always stuck with me.
George Orwell actually wrote a book about that, about going to play the arcade games. Obise to Catalonia. That was
I don't know about you, man, but what was your favourite boss in this game? Mine's is a big hermit crab with a fucking turret, bazookas on top. I've never seen anything like that, man.
Hold on.
I've never seen anything like it.
There's a lot, because I quite like, again, Shocker here, but in Mission 2, when you get to go the zombie and you're fighting like the group of the big aliens. And then you have to fight the kind of weird, like, summoning beacon. I always thought that was cool.
Oh. The Illuminati fucking symbol, like, tablet thing.
Aye. And then there's, like, big fucking Anunnakis come out of them with mad heats and shit.
But it's, like, I kind of like the fake-out last boss as well, because you fight him and you're pretty much like, oh, I'm done, dust your hands. But...
So you get spewed on half of zombies, and you can actually turn into a zombie, which... slows you down, but it also gives you an ability to vomit on people. Vomit like some sort of plasma. I think blood, is it?
Blood, aye.
And it just knocks them out. There's also serious fascist undertones in this game. There's some sort of kind of fascination with the enemy being fascists, because they've got a lot of German imagery, German U-boats, Nazi symbols on the side of U-boats and baddies and stuff. So
the baddies' flag and their symbol, if I'm right, it's just a cross, an X.
It's an X, aye.
Aye, and the style of swastika, colours, shit, I don't know.
It's in a red circle. I don't think it's black on a white background.
Weird,
it's no far off.
Ask me why I know this, but apparently it's like the nationality of the dictator guy you're fighting is Canadian, so you're fighting Canadian Nazis.
Oh, that old fascist hotbed, aye. But this game, sensory overload, man. I mean, the amount of detail in these levels, they must have spent fucking ages building everything. But, I mean, man, they fucking went for it, because you don't spend any more than like 2.5 minutes on any area. So 1 minute you could be in like this big kind of industrial complex, or you could be in like a big Arkham Asylum, or you could be in like a swamp area for Donkey Kong Country, and then all of a sudden you're fucking running about underwater with a mask on, and then you're going up the Giza pyramids, and then you're sort of running through like a manky wee medieval kind of dungeon, and then you get a gist of what I'm saying. It's just, there's so much going on. It's hard to pinpoint what the world of Metal Slug is like, other than a sort of off-green, chaotic, kind of dystopian, futuristic, fucking Rambo-inspired, mad world.
They've just
world.
Ramped everything into a fucking all-consuming war economy that has taken over planet Earth.
More or less, aye, more or less. And there's no sort of standardised body. It's just got sort of kind of caricatures of everything going on.
Actually, that's a bit like what World War II was like. Like, fighting going on all over the world.
Two had less zombies and crabs.
Possibly.
See, when you go back to the... you go to like the back in time section, when you're in like the Giza part, in the caves of Arabia, whatever it is, fucking in Egypt, whatever it's meant to be. Arabian Nights are an Egyptian thing. I don't know, right? But basically, you can tell you're back in time, because the machinery and the vehicles have got the Flintstones aspect, where they must not have any motors, so their legs are running the tanks and shit.
Nice.
Or the planes are actually attached to the roof, so they're not actually flying, they're just going along like a pulley.
That's pretty good.
So there's horrors going on, man. It's, it's very hard to kind of... And let's just talk about what it actually is, right? It's a running gun game, like Gunstar Heroes, turn up to a fucking 11 if you want to throw a Spinal Tap coin at it. That's exactly what it is.
Out of interest, Errol, was there a particular reason why you chose Metal Slug 3, or is that just the one that you're most familiar with? Because like, I've played a lot of these games and I really like them, but there's a lot of them and they're all kind of much of a muchness to me. Like, I couldn't really pick one that's a highlight for me.
3 is kind of seen as like the kind of peak of the series.
All right.
When they add in the most ludicrous stuff, like the... Mars people at the end, like, we've not even fucking talked about the Mars people. Like, you go to outer space and fight Mars people, it's awesome.
I was watching you stream as well, Aaron, and you kept saying Mars people, and I was like, the word Martians is right there.
Sure, Aero, Mars people, and I will.
Aero, what's your favourite mount, man? Your favourite slug?
Oof. I quite like the elephant, but you only get to use it for the one wee section, like, which sucks.
My favourite was a. The Dr. Robotnik boss for Sonic 2 and Emerald Hill Zone 1 with the drill.
The drill is a lot of fun. Like,
because
I don't know if I just never went
fucking
there.
Enemies everywhere.
The drill's great.
Aye, because you drive into the big kind of woodlouse things and they just kind of collapse into themselves.
I feel like you've possibly found like the perfect Andy game, because it's got big sprites, it's got mounts, and you finish it in space.
Aye.
I do prefer beat-em-ups, man. But, I mean, anything that's sort of chaotic on screen, there's hunters going on, and is a reasonable difficulty, then
it's just classic fucking arcade good times.
And you can tell it's a fucking a Neo Geo game, man. You can tell just the way it looks. They go mental for their little big sprites, man.
Sorry, I was just going to say, McCormick, you pointed out something there. Has every game I gifted one of you guys on this, you end up in outer space at some point? Because...
Well, the bouncer, for me, you fight in space, and the fucking bouncer, I remember that.
The bouncer, you go to space, and Tingle, you go to outer space as well. And I'm just like, has every game... What other games have I given you guys? Because I just had a pure, like, static moment the second you said that.
It's like me with the guns and swords, you found out something about yourself.
It was because he played James Bond in outer space and he loved it so much that now forever he just associates computer games in outer space.
Space is like a creative limit, isn't it? It's like, right, we've done everything else, where else can we go here?
Unbounded space. Possibilities.
Well,
could be ending up there.
With Metal Slug 4, they wanted you to fight Mermen as the main villain, but SNK died, and I think a different company made the fourth one, and they just reused a bunch of assets, so it's not as nice.
Also, Neo Geo, right? Neo Geo is a brilliant system. It's basically an arcade that you take home. And even in the games that you buy, they're huge because most of the arcade cabinet is actually in the cartridges. But this is one of the few games that wasn't a beat-em-up that came out for the AES Neo Geo. But if you had a Neo Geo, 90% of your games would have been fucking fighting games. But the ones like this and ones like the King of Monsters game that I gave one of these, I can't remember what it was, are kind of outliers. Aye, they're kind of outliers in that they're not just straight 2D beat-em-ups.
They had some good shooters as well, like your kind of top-down shooters.
Aye, did I.
I think we would also be remiss if we didn't talk about the fact that, if I'm right in saying, 3 is the game that brought it up to 4 playable characters for Metal Slug as well. Aaron has always been a Tarma man.
Aye.
So he's the brown-haired one with the sunglasses.
Aye.
Are they different? Do they have different kind of powers?
Later on they introduced that, but from 1 to 5, I think all the changes are just cosmetic.
Andy, who did you play as?
I just went bog standard Marco, the guy that everybody knows, the Metal Slug himself. Weak. I went on.
This was one of the games where I like to play as the lassies. I think I mostly went the blonde lassie, Eri.
I've seen her, but as I said, if I ever play through it again, I'll maybe go a different character. But there's so much going on in this game. It's kind of hard to sit here on an audio-based platform and describe Metal Slug 3. You kind of need an accompanying video, man.
Aaron, why did you gravitate so much towards the guy with the brown hair and the sunglasses initially? Did you like his attitude? Was it purely just character design? Or
it was purely the sunglasses. I was like, this guy's cool.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's about as deep as it goes.
No, that's a good enough reason.
I totally get it. It's a fucking arcade character. What more do you need?
I will say, I think I lucked out, though, because in later Metal Slugs, his gimmick is that I think when you get in a slug, it has twice as much health, and he can repair slugs, and I'm like, that's incredible, that's right up my alley.
Aye. That's useful.
Pretty cool.
Sounds like McCormick's favourite character as well, actually, if he's the if he's the tech guy.
Engineer.
Aye. Then it ends up, you're in a, obviously a big space station at the end, and that.
Well, cool actually, bit. It's got another, sorry to interrupt you, Andy, but I've just realised, it's got another fucking thing that I've heard you saying that you like a lot, which is
the aesthetics of fascism.
No. Teaming up to fight a bigger enemy.
Aye. Really, Andy.
What you do? You team up with the other side in the war, don't you, to fight the aliens
Sonic
together?
Sonic and Shadow vibes on a space station.
See, I like that. I like that because it shows that even though you've been killing each other and it's only a pure chance he's one he's isn't indeed, you still find the humanity within yourself even though you're two hedgehogs.
Is that a speech Ronald Reagan gave where he said, like, you know, if aliens invaded, then the Soviets and the United States would put aside their differences?
You would need him, man.
He was talking about Sonic Adventure 2 when he said that.
Not unless the aliens turn up at the Kremlin and say, yes, we quite like your allies better than them capitalists.
That's what they would do, let's be honest.
You also get to fight a massive brain at the end, with a horrible enemy. It's all sewed together.
Boggin looking.
That's minging. What even is that?
You're ticking all the Andy boxes here, man.
What is that thing, man? This game. Like, you're a kind of sock puppet. It's a kind of sock puppet with two boggin eyes.
A bit like a certain Mr. Andrew Ross.
Wee bit. No, remember the thing with a flubber? Weebo. You know, looks like that with a big brain hanging out of that bit.
He's got a couple of Frankenstein's monsters bolts like sticking out of it too, which is really weird.
Aye, it's a horrible looking fucking thing.
But that brings us full circle as well, back to Frankenstein's monster.
Aye, I quite like it. It's a horrible, horrible thing.
This
you can
has
tell
been
it's
your Halloween episode.
I know.
That's not far away, by the way. Not far away. He's getting any thoughts going forward? Oh well, we'll leave that. We'll leave that now.
Obviously, I want to hear some final thoughts from both of you because this is obviously a huge nostalgia hit for Aero as well, so I'm sure he's still got plenty more to say on it. But recommendations, anything you've not talked about yet that you want to bring up, what we got in terms of wrapping this up?
Aye, so it's got shit going on that you're not going to see on any home consoles for the 16-bit era, but it's got all this stuff from the best kind of 2D running gun games, but they're all tuned up because the Neo Geo AES just had the ability to do everything at the time, and it was made at a time where 2D was pretty much perfected by that time. So it's a perfect running gun title if you're into that sort of thing. It'll blow your fucking mind because there's so much going on the screen. But just to keep a bit aware of that, man, that there's so much going on the screen. If you like how you laid back kind of text adventure like you were talking about earlier on, it might not be for you.
I was going to say, I don't think you can get more polar opposites than a text adventure and Metal Slug. Aye, Metal Slug, I mean, you go from fighting giant crabs to zombies to faux Nazis to plant monsters back to Nazis to Mars people. It's great. I'm happy it's not a Deed franchise because it's got that new strategy spin-off coming out, which looks dino.
That looks fucking class.
It looks so good. It's by the same people that published Streets of Rage 4. Oh nice. My god, it's going to be great. I'm so happy. It's so easily available. Like, you can find it on Steam. You can find it on like practically any virtual console thing.
Without having to spend your life savings on like credits in the arcade.
I like when I streamed it, it counted the amount of times I had to use a continue. 42. So that would have been £42 just to get to the end.
I've got a question for you. Here we go, man. Antiques Roadshow time, right? How much do you reckon, without looking, that a nice copy of Metal Slug 3 for the Neo Geo NES would set you back in 2021?
Oh, so just the actual game itself?
Just the cartridge, aye. Or if you want, then aye, just go for the cartridge. You can't really get them, just cartridges.
I'm going to say £1,099.
I'm not going to go as high as that. I'm going to say £250.
Oh, well off, man.
I'll go with £750.
Oh. First one's actually closest, man. £2,500.
But was this not one of the most popular of the fucking of the Neo Geo games? Were they?
Neo Geo games, basically. Andy knows a bit more about this. They more or less had a fucking arcade board in them. They were incredibly expensive even back then. Like, no many people had them.
Aye, that's the thing. It's it wasn't a arcade port. It was the actual fucking arcade game. So the AES is a weird console, but the inside of an AES only sort of has like video components and like a processor. The actual
So the cartridge is actually what the game is running on.
Aye, pretty much.
Yeah. So you're buying like, every game, you're basically buying a console, effectively.
Pretty much.
It probably costs so much.
And there's not many of them about either. It was a console that was. You ever seen the film Richie Rich? He would have had an AES.
Maybe Rick McMenemy had one when his granny won the lottery.
It was definitely an opportunity to get one in. But yeah, you wouldn't have found an AES at GeForce or that, or if you did, it would have just been like held up away out of reach of you, man, so you can never get it.
Ah. Exactly.
There's no cunt in Greenock. Maybe Mr. Soapshoes. Apart from that, no cunt is going to have an AES in Greenock.
I like you're doing better because we've introduced like an innuendo now. I think we could actually get away with just saying Mr. Soapshoes. But yeah, Aero fully lives up to your childhood nostalgia and all that. Does it ever make you feel like you're a wee boy on holiday in Spain fucking looking at an arcade cabinet full of wonder?
No, because there's no wee Geordie guy annoying me. Nah. Take that, whatever your name was. But
that, I fucking love budgies.
Experience. So.
Honestly, not really, because I'm not constantly having to annoy our dad for more pocket change. But the kind of just being able to finally actually get past the second mission and doing everything is great. I'm happy, Andy. Fucking loved it too, by the sounds of it.
Aye.
It'd be impossible, they don't even mint pesetas anymore.
Hey, Mick, I'm surprised, McCormick, I'm surprised you never, well, I suppose you never played it, did you? But some famous company made the music, the Noise Factory, apparently, I don't know the fuck.
Ah.
Some sort of separate studio from the developers.
tunes are kind of functional. They're like kind of heroic military music a lot of the time, and then, you know, as you say, there's like a pyramid level and they go for kind of different musical motifs. I don't think any I can't think of a tune that really fucking blew my mind.
There's no metal slog tune. That's all. There's
I was
not
actually going to say, one tune does pure stick out for me because they put in the new Smash Bros game to represent SNK. So it's literally the starting one, the do-do-do-do,
yeah. Right, okay, I suppose you could put that one through. You're too busy kind of getting a kind of visual fucking optical overload, man.
All your other senses have been stimulated.
Well, I'm too busy trying to get the wee guy to go thank you and get his pants out. It's the best part of the game.
Aye, that is definitely good.
Well, Aero, thank you for joining us on this episode of Dynamite Neddy.
Get your tights ready for the next one. Your tights and boots for maybe the next one that you'll be on.
Well, for when Aero's coming back, yes. That's a, well,
Robin Hood special.
But yeah, I guess we've got a wrestling special coming soon-ish. But up next, we've just got Bog Standard, Mince and Totties. Andy, I'm going to give you the greatest 8-bit beat-em-up of all time. It is, well, in PAL regions, it was known as Street Gangs, much better known as River City Ransom on the Nintendo.
Sounds good to me. Sounds good. Can't wait. Young Team Simulator.
get all the fucking BBC Scotland jokes out now.
you can't play as Shell Suit Bob, etc. Oh, et
man. What about Lenny?
He's in it. he actually is one of the, I think one of the sub-bosses is called Lenny. Right, Andy, what are you getting to McCormick?
Oh, we're going to have one of Nakasan's kind of deviations for the Sonic series. I'm going to give him Nights into Dreams for the Sega Saturn, or the remaster, whichever one's easier.
Amazing.
Another big hitter.
It doesn't talk in it.
One of these games that we've mentioned a million times. Always good to get a Sonic team game. And for Mick, a classic RPG on the PS1, which is a lot of kind of nostalgia for me, being the first JRPG I think I ever played. That is, hope I'm pronouncing this right, Suikoden 2 on the PlayStation 1.
Oh,
you've just offended so many Japanese people.
I'll commit a seppuku.
I know what you like, McCormick.
I want to talk.
Well, it's actually based, I've played the first gen, and it's based on a fucking Chinese myth about 100 heroes that overthrow like a fucking evil emperor or something like that. And the first gen, there was like 100 people you could gather and get into your party or whatever. But I've heard that 2 is just a better version of 1, so I've wanted to play that for a wee while. So sounds like three fucking big hitters.
Nice one.
Trackers next time.
Sounds good to be, man. Let's do it.
Aero, why don't you play as it?
This has been Dynamite Neddy. We pumped your maw, we shagged your gran, and we bumped your uncle.
Calm down, Christian.
I don't know, it's been a while.